It is Saturday, July 18th, 2009, 10:06 a.m. on the Central Coast of California. Today on Geek Speak, geek news and questions and comments about technology from guess who? From you. That's right, you can call in today. Welcome to Geek Speak, bridging the gaps between geeks and the rest of humanity. I'm your host, Lyle Troxell. Please keep in mind the views expressed during Geek Speak are not necessarily those of KUSP. Today on our program, we'll be taking your calls and questions about comments about technology. In the second half, you can answer anything you'd like. So you can ask us anything you'd like. The first half, we'll be doing news. The numbers are 476-2800 or toll-free at 1-800-655-5877. Of course, all week long, you can ask us questions through email or participate in our forums. We're here to help. I'll give out that contact information again when I invite your participation in about a half an hour. This is Geek Speak. My name's Lyle Troxell. In the air with me, I have geeks. Miles Elam, he's a former slacker, currently an instructor at Stanford, and always a political junkie. Morning, Miles.
Good morning.
My headphones are only half working today, so I might only be half on track today. We also have Al Luckow. He's a new media architect, and good morning, Al.
Hi.
All right, so we're going to take news in the second. We're going to take calls in the second half, and we'll be taking any kind of call you want. And, of course, we welcome you to add to our discussion. In fact, all week long, you're welcome to add to our discussion and make us sound even smarter by adding information. So, for example, this week, a few of our listeners, thank you very much, submitted the same story because it's so fantastically horrible. What's going on with robots lately, Al?
Oh, man. This is a really good one. And it's been around, and there's a lot of people have been reporting on it, but I actually did like further research and found the source. There's a company, RTI, that has developed what most websites out there are calling a corpse-eating robot. It's called the Energetically Autonomous Tactical Robot, or EATER.
Oh, no.
Patent pending.
Does it eat and not do it? Does it use this thing that it eats?
It's kind of designed to go, like, in the battlefield and gather organic material to recharge itself. And what I found through reading the documentation, it says about 3 to 12 pounds of vegetation, organic things, produces about 1 kilowatt hour. And that the power translates to 2.8 miles of driving or more.
Oh, so every 2.8 miles of driving, it has to eat how many pounds? Like 4 pounds?
3 to 12.
3 to 12 pounds of material.
And it's called driving. And, you know, essentially the idea is that, you know, if you can, you know, consume this organic material,
you don't need a battery.
You know,
or it charges.
Yeah, and you know, you have these things like, I don't know, say on the battlefield.
Well, it's interesting.
You know, it starts, oh, all these dead bodies over here, and I can get around. And what's going to happen when all of a sudden it realizes, oh, I'm out of dead bodies. Maybe I should make some more dead bodies. You know, to keep going.
What could possibly go wrong?
Well, make some dead bodies is one thing. As long as it's not going, I wonder how they taste alive.
Yeah.
No, well, make dead bodies is not good.
I know.
And even being eaten so that you're not alive anymore is not good.
And now,
but wait a second. We've had a lot of stories about robots that are using, like, because we had the robots that could capture, the clock that could capture flies and eat them.
So flies are one thing.
Yeah.
Okay. But this is like,
but driving around and eating
and
stuff.
And finding, what can I find? You know, and there's a couple things. When I went through, I like downloaded their presentation and stuff because I didn't want to just read all the sensationalized stuff.
Right, because corpse eating robots is pretty sensational.
I mean, wow, you know, what are you trying to give me the best thing in the world to talk about? And I downloaded the presentation. And
like
guess who?
The corporate presentation, like they do to the military and try to sell this thing?
The TDARPA, yeah.
Yeah.
And guess who gives it from the company? Dr. Robert Finkelstein. Or is it Funkelstein? I'm not sure.
Great.
Well, anyway,
thank you.
It's just too perfect. I mean, is this like orchestrated?
Was he young?
Now we've been talking about the corpse flesh-eating robots.
You read the documentation. Wait a second. So it's driving around. Let's assume that there aren't dead bodies around, and it's just eating material. Right. Like it can go and eat plant life and, yeah, and leaves and stuff. But if it runs into like a tree, does it cut the tree down and start consuming it?
No,
or is it more passive?
It's sort of designed to pick up things that are easily picked up and eaten.
And does it have like a lawnmower blade on it? So if it goes through a field, it can just take all the wheat, you know, that kind of thing?
I don't think so.
It just has to
pick
stuff up.
Although, I mean, when you really think about it, the product is consuming material for food, and what exactly is it consuming the material for?
For power, to make electricity.
Okay, so it's consuming this product. What happens when you consume something?
You have poop. That's the headline.
So they don't seem to mention
robot
that in
poops.
Any of this stuff. What are all these cubes out here in the battlefield?
Right, what does it look like? It's probably just some kind of weird
They don't even
mush.
Talk. I mean, there's got to be something left mush. Over from it. They don't talk about it. I mean, these are things that I want to know.
Wait, what's the stuff that that infants have for the first, like, 7 days out of the womb?
Oh, I don't know.
It doesn't. Marcomium.
Yeah, marcomium, yeah. It doesn't smell, though.
No, but I hope it's not like that. Like that tarry, horrible
icky,
thing.
Yeah,
yeah. Because it's hard to clean.
Well, so we talk about the marcomium and the poop and flesh eating and all that kind of stuff. But there is something truly terrifying about this project.
Wait, that's not the terrifying
no,
stuff?
That's,
that it can
that's,
eat
that's
corpses and then it goes to the bathroom?
Corpse eating, ripping limbs, you know. Okay, there's something truly terrifying about this. And I think it's our duty to warn listeners, you know, more sensitive listeners out there that may want to be sitting down. Mm-hmm. In the next 30 seconds, I'm going to tell you something that maybe is difficult to...
About the corpse-eating
robot. Corpse-eating, pooping...
Robot.
Battlefield robots.
Okay.
This is directly quoted from the presentation. We are using Microsoft Robotics Development Studio 2008.
So the scary part is that it runs on Windows?
What,
or it runs
what
on
could go wrong? I don't know.
Oh, no.
I've
no,
never
no,
had
no.
anything go wrong with the
I'm just scared about looking. Like, I want to envision the code, you know, the subroutine, you know, is creature alive? Yes. Don't eat. Wait, is that right?
Yeah. Do eat or don't?
Do eat? Wait, this is not symbol before the equal
man.
Sign.
There's just, it couldn't have been more perfect.
Okay, thank you.
Yep.
I think we're done with robot stories forever.
That one,
unless there's
I can't
one that
imagine.
Can climb a tree and then also do that.
I mean, if you hear of one, send it in. But man,
yes. Al,
wow.
Isn't
Eater?
It true that why don't we have lawnmowers that do this? I mean, that'd be awesome. Lawnmower cuts the grass, gets powered from the grass, runs all the time.
It'd be a great idea. Yeah, or grass, or mice, or cats, or anything that is in the yard when it's doing its work.
How about dog feces? If it could pick up dog feces and be powered by that, then we'd be set.
I don't know if that's the used material.
Yeah,
or...
probably not. Wow, we've covered a lot of disgusting things today.
Anyway.
All right. And that's only the first news story.
That's just it. And that's the, you know.
Thank you, Al.
Mm-hmm. Robot
Miles?
Report.
Miles, hi. How you doing?
Well, since we're in kind of a biological realm right now, I figure I'll keep with that as a theme and talk about the ability to sequence the human genome. Now, to give an idea, the Human Genome Project, which a good portion of it was done locally here at University of California at Santa Cruz.
That's where I work.
Yes, and that took 13 years to fully sequence a single human genetic information. The researcher who was working on it, actually. The
oh, really?
Researcher
is that the first
one? Yeah. It was his genome. Recent advances have it where it is now possible to sequence an entire human genome in 1 week. The first time was 13 years. Now, a few years later, only a few years later,
right. It's
down to 1 week.
So you're saying that if someone gets a sample of you, they can get your full sequence?
Yes.
And then theoretically...
Well, I mean, the thing is, this is still a massive effort. This is...
No, there's a lot of work being done.
Right, for a single human genome. But,
well, he opened up the door. I mean, probably a lot of... I'm thinking it was he, it could have been she, but they opened up the door for sequencing and maybe they innovated... techniques or something? Or
yeah. Well, yeah, that's the idea.
Post-processing power.
Well, you know, when they first started talking about being able to do this, they talked about it being, decades to do this.
Mm-hmm.
And it got faster and faster, and now it's down to a week.
Well, it wasn't decades. It was a little more than one decade.
But, but when they had planned, first started, even the 13 years, that was really impressive. They'd done a lot of tricks.
Right. But, yeah, because they had a whole bunch of computer scientists working with them
it got a lot
algorithms
better.
For it. Right.
Yeah. So if it can do it in a week now, how long until you can do it in an afternoon?
Or for that matter, how long before it becomes a week for any random patient that wants to come in and have the lab results done? Because that's probably what's going to happen is you're going to have to expand it out to a whole bunch of different people. I guess it would be possible that you'd put a drop of blood into a machine and it goes, you will die of a heart attack when you're 45. But,
jeez, that's weird.
But
no, it'd be the other ones that are
in, good at a carnival.
But at the same time, we are now getting closer to the point where we need to ask the questions that were raised in movies like Gattaca. You put a drop of blood down and you take a sample of urine or whatever, and you're able to say, this is our profile. This is who we are.
I mean, I'm assuming it's getting to the point where it's – you know, it's a week of work. I'm sure it's very expensive. A lot of people doing it. It's not streamlined. But still, if it's possible to do it in a week, that means it's, you know, less than $500,000 to do it, let's assume.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're talking about that, you're saying, well, why not sequence astronauts? Why not sequence large political figures, you know? I mean, start doing the people that are important in the sense that it might be gain information. It's kind of creepy that you're going to soon collect a database of what people are made of. Here's an interesting thing. If that starts happening at a later date, you could clone from just printing out their DNA sequence. I mean, I'm talking about a later date, meaning we don't have the technology to do that, but you theoretically could, right?
I'm not going to comment on that because you're taking a mental leap there neither of us is qualified to make.
Okay, fine. We'll go on though.
But that is still an issue, and I also think of the healthcare debate that's going on right now of if everyone has health insurance, this becomes a novelty, a way for diagnostic information that becomes useful. If you still have, you know, 49 million people who don't have insurance and a lot of people who are underinsured, you know, many more millions that are underinsured, this becomes a real threat. This becomes an issue of, well, we'll just sequence you and find out whether or not you will get a disease sometime in the future, whether or not you're healthier.
Or if you have a 40% more likely chance to get cancer, or, you know, the whole thing.
Right, and end up your premiums as a result. So that also becomes part of the debate now for what we do for healthcare in the future.
Right. All right. Well, thank you for the update on 1 week of a full sequence. It's kind of incredible.
Yeah.
Hi, Al.
Hey.
How's it going?
Good.
You know, I'm going to leave it up to you, but I think onions.
Okay.
Personally,
I talked about power.
Yes.
So
robot power.
Mm-hmm. So there's other alternative methods to have power that are interesting. Okay. There's the one that I think I should talk about first, which is pee power.
Well, of course, because why wouldn't you?
Yeah. Apparently, hydrogen is a great source of energy, but the problem is it takes so much energy to get the hydrogen.
Yes.
It's like, you can't do it. Well, they've discovered a way that they can get hydrogen out of...
Urine.
Yes.
Okay.
Specifically, urea.
Mm-hmm.
Instead of splitting water, which is how they do it now, and it ends up fouling the water and everything, urea, it's the component in urine, they can get that to break down and liberate the hydrogen from that. It requires a lot less energy.
Interesting.
And it's still challenging, but they have to get to it before the bacteria get a chance to metabolize it.
Mm-hmm.
But apparently pee power is being studied.
That's actually interesting. That means there's people that have their business cards and it says pee power.
Pee professional.
Mm-hmm.
So that's one thing.
So does this imply that in the future, if you really wanted to put this into production, for example,
you just put your cell phone on the ground and unzip and do your business?
Well, I was thinking more on the municipal level. Do you have to go into one receptacle for number one and another receptacle for number two?
Well, you do. You kind of guys do that now, kind of.
That's true.
You ever been to a concert? you could power a city.
Yeah, that's true.
I'm assuming that you would want actual urea and not the other things that come associated with excretia.
Can we? We need a title for today's show. Start thinking about that.
Well, okay, we'll go on to the other.
I'm trying to think of all sorts of words that I can use to describe it that won't get me in trouble or have some profanity.
Well, there's another power source. We'll just go straight into something that personally I find even more repulsive.
Can I say one thing? That what? Miles, you're the actual representative for the FCC today. Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
So there's another way you can get power, and the other way is through onions.
Tear power? Like you start crying?
Just power.
You frustrate power production until it goes, fine, I'll give you a whole bunch of kilowatts. peeling and peeling.
This company, Gillis Onions, which is a Southern California farming giant, they boast the largest fresh onion processing plant in the world, which is a place I will never go. Just telling you.
You know they wear like hazmat suits and stuff, right?
They say they produce 300,000 pounds of onion waste a day. All right.
Onion waste. Okay. Yep. I'm sorry.
The company unveiled Friday a clever scheme to convert onion byproducts into electricity.
So we're talking about the plant material, we're talking about the part of the shell and the root structure that's
they're
not
saying
the onion
onions,
itself.
The yeah. onion waste. Right. So the waste part of the onion that you no longer need, which there doesn't seem like there's that much to an onion, but maybe the
Well, there's the whole upper plant.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, they have some anaerobic digester that converts treated onion plant waste into biogas, mm-hmm. and then that gas is conditioned and turned into methane and the component natural gas and blah, nice. Blah, blah. So see, it's fed into a 600 kilowatt fuel cell to make electricity.
Cool.
So
all off of onions.
It's they said it's a project that they're focusing on now, and they're getting investors, and they've got people investing in it already, and they've already gotten
this kind of way of saying, well, we have a large company doing this processing, mm-hmm. and we have this waste material. Let's turn it right into electricity. Mm-hmm. It's pretty cool. I mean,
it's a good use of stuff that you're just gonna throw away. I mean, I think there's a lot of uses for onion waste.
They could just sprinkle it on battlefields, and then the robots can
then the battlefield robot. But really, things like organic waste you could use to replenish crop. Soil.
Yeah.
I mean, you can do a lot of things with waste that...
That's true.
But, you know, they found a power source from onions, which is, fine. That's a good use for onions.
That is an interesting idea, though, that the power is, you know, the material in the onion is mm-hmm. coming from the air, the carbon, mm-hmm. There's a lot of it, and then the nitrogen from the soil and from right. the air. But it's a lot of work has to be done to make fields grow,
right?
The traditional ways of crop rotation, mm-hmm. if they're just an onion producer... Whether they do that or not, who knows? And of course, they're probably just buying onions from farmers, and those farmers are putting a whole bunch of stuff in the ground to make
fertilizers. Them work. So the chemicals cycle, and you could just reuse the onion.
Maybe you could do it more directly, but it is kind of neat that it's doing
onion power.
Yeah,
there you have it.
Miles, since you're the political junkie, can we talk a little bit about copyright and the strangeness that's happening with electronic books?
Yes. There was a news story a while back, I can't remember exactly when, where I talked about how people were downloading their books on a Kindle, the Amazon Kindle.
It's a small electronic reading device.
Right. And some hubbub that came up when a person also had an iPhone and they downloaded it onto the Kindle app on the iPhone to start reading there. It's a really useful feature to read on one device, and then when you're done, you can go back to the other device and it knows where you left off.
Oh, it knows
with
that?
The second device, yeah.
Oh, that's kind of cool.
Yeah. And then he bought a Kindle too. And all of a sudden, he got this message saying, this book is no longer available for download. He's like, wait a second, but I bought this book. What's going on? Mm. I'm just recapping the story.
Sure.
And it was because the publishers had decided that it could only be downloaded three times. He had reinstalled the Kindle app on the iPhone. That's what it
So he ran out of the amount of legal downloads for
right,
this
except
one
for
user.
The fact that the on Amazon's site, you can't know ahead of time how many downloads you have.
Oh. Who decides that? The publisher?
The publisher. So each book can be different, and you have no way of knowing ahead of time when you're buying it electronically.
The thing that's crazy about that is that those hardware devices, those will mm-hmm. degrade a lot faster than a book. Like within seven years, those devices will not be functional. So, or not usable very much.
So it'd be like going to your library.
Flash memory?
Well, no, it might be functional, but it's not going to be something you're using because the newest technology is going to be so much superior that you'll have it on, what are those things that hold bookshelves? So you'll have your old Kindles lined up and the books will be trapped on those devices.
So you might be going and getting a traditional book out of your bookshelf and, I'll take this book, and you can't open it.
Right.
It doesn't open. What happened to this book?
Right.
It's like all the pages are glued together.
Yeah.
Yes, but it gets worse, folks.
Okay. This is what, the news story?
This is the news story. So this is your background to know that, okay, this is the situation it was before. The ante has been upped. You have a case where some folks who had bought a couple of books electronically and they had it on their Kindle woke up one morning to find those books had been remotely deleted.
And okay, like, so someone broke into the
house.
But
I was reading that.
No. Wirelessly, over the internet, it had been deleted by Amazon.
And with Al's example of not being able to open the last book, this is you come into your library and the books, or you come to your books, you look over your nightstand and when you wake up in the morning and it's not there.
Well, except that it would be the equivalent of someone walks in, takes your book away, and then leaves a check for the cost of the book.
They're going to pay the people back.
They're crediting their accounts anyway.
Okay, first off, why did they erase the book? But more importantly, how did they do that? Is that they can do that with anything?
After the fact. After
they sold them.
After they had sold them, after people had purchased them and had been reading them, the publisher decided, you know what? We really don't want to do electronic books anymore. And Amazon lives and breathes by making publishers happy. If the publishers aren't happy, then Amazon suddenly has no business model anymore.
At least in the electronic book area, which they're trying to kind of get a hold of.
If publishers decided they didn't want to work with Amazon and give them cheap prices and bulk prices,
I think you're undercutting how much power Amazon has.
Okay.
I think if Amazon says, we're not going to cover your book anymore, the publisher's not happy. But in the electronic world, electronic book space, where they're trying to prove this new idea where they don't even need publishers
anymore.
And
there aren't enough Kindle customers.
Right.
Okay.
Because, of course, Amazon's model with the Kindle is eventually you don't need a big publisher, right? You write a good book, Miles. You talk to Amazon. They put it on their electronic store. No printing, no publisher. Amazon and you are the only people that are involved.
Well, even for big publishers, that's an issue. You don't have the printing costs.
That's right. So that idea, that model of Amazon is very beneficial. So they're careful right now about the publishers.
A publisher decided, we don't want to do electronic books after all. So ex post facto, they decided that some books by the author George Orwell should not be owned anymore.
It only gets better.
On the Kindle.
What books?
The books just happened to be Animal Farm and 1984.
Yes.
Which raises the question, is there someone at these publishing companies that is following along with what the executives are saying, but deciding, like, which books could we do that would make a better story? Like, I can't make this up.
It's too perfect. I couldn't even think of a better story than that.
Or maybe it's more evil than that. Maybe someone at the large publishing company was like, wait, we're selling 1984, but we don't want people to know that information. Let's not sell that. Okay, creepy. Yeah. So they erased the books remotely from someone's home. Some corporation, which of course is a contracted entity from the U.S. government.
Right. Contrary to what I would believe would be the wishes of the author. If you had read a bunch of the stuff that George Orwell had written, not just in those books, but his outside
his
essays.
And his,
he was trying to warn us of this kind of activity.
Right. Oh, that's awesome that it's his book. Let's assume that there was 1,000 books that they erased and just happened to be the best two to talk about would be Animal Farm and 1984. Because, please, that's too perfect.
Well, 1984 was, I mean, the story was about the guy is, you know, a news headline comes in and says, okay, this isn't going to be right. Let's change this to make it more along the lines of party lines.
Right.
You know, and this information, this is inconvenient, so we're going to burn that.
Right. And this book, we don't want to sell this anymore, so we're going to erase it from your home. Mm-hmm. It's right in line with that. Okay, thank you for that creepiness. And so that's Amazon doing that kind of...
Amazon in collusion with publishers.
I gotta say, the more I hear about Kindles, I mean, I like some of the ideas of it, but I'm gonna say no way. Like,
they're
total
just,
boycott.
You know,
just the idea of it disturbs me. The idea that you can only download them a few times, you don't really own it, it sounds like. It's more like you're leasing it. Yuck. Forget it.
Right.
Paper's
well, someone
nice
say, like, you don't own your book, you only own that copy. Like, fine, well, let me own the electronic copy, too. Like,
plus,
what is...
they're gonna wipe out the whole bookmark business.
I know, bookmarks. And they're fun
all
to make.
All these companies out there making bookmarks.
You know,
out of business. Well, we were doing good until that Kindle came out. It keeps track of where you are.
Here's my family recommendation for you this weekend. Go ahead and sit down with your kids and make a bookmark. It's so easy. They're fun. And then as you're reading books, if you do read books, you can think about your kids' art. It's a lot of fun to do.
Yeah, although
and don't
the iPhone is not as convenient as the Kindle. I have an app called Stanza on it. And I'm, you know,
and can you get
works of Shakespeare.
Can you get Orwell's books on that?
I don't know. I haven't tried. So
you can illegally, I bet.
I'm sure I can illegally.
Or I shouldn't say illegally, by breaking copyright. All right. Thank you, Miles, for that wonderful story on the freaky, creepy world we live in. You're listening to Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP, Santa Cruz, KBDH, San Arto, streaming live and podcasting at KUSP.org. This is Geek Speak. My name's Lyle Troxell. In the air with me, I have Miles Elam and Al Luckow. We're talking about the news of the week. We're also today are taking your calls with questions and comments about technology. If you'd like to add something to the stories that we're talking about, or if you've got a question you think would be an interesting thing for us to answer, please feel free to give us a ring. The phone numbers are 476-2800. Again, 476-2800. And that's in the 831 area code, which is most of our listening area. And you can also call us toll-free, of course, anywhere in the U.S., Canada, and so on. 1-800-655-5877. Again, that's 1-800-655-KUSP. Al, it's your turn for news stories. I'm going to go ahead and ask you to talk about typewriters and the police.
Oh, yeah. Speaking of technology, this is something that's quite interesting.
Just like the electronic reader, right?
Yeah. I mean, you know, we're talking bookmarks and old books and stuff. New York City has plunked down $1 million for typewriters.
What's that? What's a typewriter?
Back in the day, sometimes you see these in movies. There are these big machines with all these little, you know, hot metal things in it. And when you press the button, the metal thing swings and then hits the paper in through a ribbon of ink, and then embeds the letter form onto the paper.
So it's like really quick printing press?
Well, you have to do it multiple times, and the little things snap up and they
Wait,
type.
Does this look like a keyboard?
And at the same time, it slides to the left. Okay, and it keeps going until you get to the end of the paragraph, and then there's a bing, and then you have to, depending on whether it's electronic or manual, you have to, like, slide it back, and then at the same time, it goes down one thing. So
the New York Police Department just popped down $1 million for typewriters.
Well, just not the, well, because these are, like, sort of Rube Goldberg-type things, you know, right. Press this button, you know.
Yeah.
Then you have to have your service maintenance agreement.
Absolutely.
Because these things need oil, and I don't know, they run on coal or something.
Got to change the ribbons out.
$99,000 with AFAX Business Machines in Manhattan for the maintenance of its brother Panasonic and IBM's electric typewriters.
Why?
And they also buy carbon paper.
And is it carbon paper to make duplicates?
Well,
when you're creating it?
When you take this paper and you put it underneath the paper you're typing on, and because this is a percussion thing, it can actually push the impression to another piece of paper. Obviously, there's a point of failure when it's number of papers, it's so light you can't see it. But they buy the carbon paper to make a copy of it.
Just like that ribbon thing you were talking about, the carbon paper is really like the ribbon.
So they have to buy ribbon, and they have to buy the carbon paper, and they have to buy the paper, and they have to buy service.
So here's a thought. First off, we think, of course, this is to some degree ridiculous, but then again, if they switch over to computers, it's more...
Well, they have computers.
Orwellian, thank you. It's much more Orwellian if they got everything on the computers. Or are they putting it on the computers as well? Because if you have a lot of data on a computer about a lot of people, you have power and...
Except you also have data retention issues. The fact of what happens when a hard drive fails.
Exactly.
You with paper things,
you don't have to worry about fire. And if you're doing the carbon copy right away, you put it in two locations.
And honestly, I actually do have fond memories of childhood where there was this really rickety old black typewriter. And my mom had this really nice, you know, white typewriter that had nice key action. And I was like, can I use that one? She's like, not until you learn to put your fingers in the right place.
Was it Elite or Pika?
I have actually no memory of that.
I just remember
learning that I couldn't do a single finger press, you know, the Hunt and Peck style. I actually had to put my fingers at the, you know, ASDF and JKL
semicolon. I learned how to
type
on a typewriter, too. Yeah, and the manual one that I had, that my father had, was really hard to press.
And like, once
he
started,
could do it fast because his fingers were strong. But I remember as a kid, it was hard for me to press them.
Once I started doing that, she's like, okay, now you can use the real typewriter.
The
and that's
one.
Where a lot of my typing skills came from.
Right.
So
I remember the Olivetti typewriters, they had a ball. You know, like a metal ball. It was like a little
rotating
globe, and you had the Elite size, which was, I think, 9 point, and Pica, which was 12 point. And, you know, somebody would always take the elite ball. Where, you know, I remember being in school, in college, and we had to use it. Who's got the elite ball? You know, and you just swap the ball out. And it was so
different font size.
Yeah, I want the new one, you know, and it's just.
It sounds like a piece from an Unreal Tournament
I can't believe
game. Like,
the elite ball is missing.
Our kids are going to just not believe all these stories about records and tapes and typewriting machines. And, you know.
At Boomeria in Bonnie Doon, a castle and stuff, I'll take you there sometime now, there's rotary phones. And high school students come by. And about 5 years ago, a high school student was like, I need to call my mom, and can I use your phone? And Boom, who owns the property, pointed over the phone. And the kid came over, and it was the greatest thing. He picked up the phone, he heard the dial tone, and then he pushed his fingers in the holes. It's awesome.
Oh, man.
Boom was like, oh.
we're in a transitionary time, you know. We really are.
So
anyway, they spent $1 million.
Maybe it's a good thing that they're doing it on paper. You don't have to worry about hard drives.
I'm just reporting
all
on
right.
this.
Thank you very much for that.
Yep. Yeah,
appreciate it. Looks like we've got calls. I don't know where we are on the
that
calls.
Light's been blinking. I
know. There's
is that what that means?
There.
It depends on which.
Or does
which
it mean emergency?
It gosh, it's in Santa Cruz, and Doug's on the phone.
Or is it the bat phone?
Hi, Doug. Welcome to Geek Speak.
Hello. Good morning.
Good morning. What's your question?
Yes, I have Windows Internet Explorer, and a couple of weeks ago I saw something on my Yahoo homepage in the news about there was a virus that was hiding itself as, what the heck was I called, ActiveX, I think it is. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, those stories are almost weekly. It's surprising they got to the Yahoo front page, but it must have been a little different.
And if you click on this update,
if you accept the ActiveX component, it actually installs a virus. Yeah, that's one of the core fundamental problems with Internet Explorer. It's one of the reasons why we recommend people not use Internet Explorer except for the things they need, because it is so easy to activate a remote application, basically. You just have to get a yes and then kind of remove some warning messages by saying yes again, and then you've got some remote application running on your computer, which is really what a virus is, an application running you don't want.
Isn't
active? Because I'm getting that in my Microsoft update.
Okay, so Microsoft updates, trust those. That's okay.
It's asking for an add-on, and it's asking for ActiveX. That would be okay.
So if you're at Microsoft.com, make sure you are. Of course, it's possible you're not really at Microsoft.com. That's a more complicated problem.
It says Miles, Microsoft.com, Microsoft update,
right,
dash
right.
V6
so,
default.
So here's the thing that's most likely Microsoft, but the thing that's clever about viruses that are smart is that it can tell you that it's Microsoft if it's running on your computer right now.
Yeah.
Either you've got an infection or your machine's okay, and you don't know that necessarily right now. But what I would do, because you're more likely to be safe if you keep updating from Microsoft as much as possible. So I would go to Microsoft.com, actually go to the start menu up at the top. There's software update. That will take you to Microsoft. Go ahead and accept all those things, because its new ActiveX stuff is probably going to protect you from some known viruses. So the sooner you do that, the safer your experience is. Miles?
But
the only thing that I'm wondering about is every once in a while lately I've noticed that my cursor is moving without me moving the mouse.
Your computer's just getting a brain and becoming sentient. I wouldn't really worry about that part. But
if it is moving without your volition, there may be someone who's doing like a remote desktop on
your
system.
Possible. When you say removing, is it slowly kind of moving in one direction, or does it move in any kind of curves or circles or any change?
No, it just slowly moves in one direction.
Oh, okay.
And once
that's
grab the mouse, I get control.
Wait,
right
it's
back.
Most likely your mouse is just a little strange. What you can do if it does it regularly, just take your mouse and is it an optical mouse? Does it have a ball in it, or does it have like a light?
Ball.
A ball. Yeah, that kind of thing is.
Or
not
maybe he's bought a Kindle recently.
And they're erasing.
No, that's you should not worry about that. That's actually very normal with mice, that you'll have it tracking right across the screen very slowly. That's a normal thing with mice.
That's just a bug.
Especially on an uneven surface.
When it starts really going wild.
It's if it changes direction.
And you have no control.
If it looks like someone's using it.
Yeah, if it looks like it's going towards specific buttons or menu items and doing things, that's when you have to worry. If it's just tracking slowly right, that's just a...
So here's our standard suggestion. Update Microsoft Update as much as possible, assuming you own Windows. And then start running Firefox as your main browser.
Firefox, Safari. Chrome, Google Chrome.
Firefox is an
Mozilla?
Easy one. Yeah, Mozilla Firefox mm-hmm. is actually
yeah,
the...
Mozilla yeah, Mozilla Firefox is okay.
Yeah, that's what we recommend. The reason is that it's a little more difficult to run ActiveX components directly in there.
So it's a little bit clunky, though. I find Microsoft to be very, you know...
Try Safari.
Easy to use.
Yeah.
But Mozilla's pretty good.
Yeah, the thing...
Try the newest versions, actually.
Yeah, try the most recent version. I agree. And the other thing about it is...
There's another version.
Well, there's new versions all the time. But the reason that it feels clunky is much more that you've trained your body and your experience to work with Internet Explorer.
Uh-huh.
So when you switch to something else,
yeah,
it doesn't feel
you.
Normal, right?
Right.
Just
okay.
like if you had a different type of tread on your stair. If you walk that enough times, your body will get used to it, and then anything else is going to seem strange.
That
so if you're training on a racing bike and all of a sudden you go to a mountain bike,
it's going to be really creepy. That's yeah. what Miles did recently.
And but after a while, you're going to go, man, this mountain bike is the greatest.
Yeah, it takes a little bit okay. of time, and it's... But it might be worth it just to spend a couple of hours one particular evening and download all the different browsers that are out there. Fire it up and say, this looks like it. I like this one better yeah. than that one.
Okay.
And then the ones that you don't use, you just go to add or remove programs, delete it, and you just use the one that you like the best.
And there's one other thing you could do with Firefox if you really wanted to be like Internet Explorer. There's actually add-ons for Firefox. I think they're called add-ons, and you can look at a whole bunch of them. Some of them actually reskin the browser to make it look and feel more like Internet Explorer. And that might be something that is appealing to you. Or
all
you could
right.
train yourself again. Mm-hmm. In any case, thank you so much for the call, Doug.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Yeah, it's funny. With so many browsers out there, it's like the very worst one is Internet Explorer.
Mm-hmm.
Just by right. almost any measure that you go from. It's either standards compliance or how fast it renders or how fast it works with Google Mail, for example, and JavaScript performance. It's like... All of them are better than Internet Explorer.
Isn't ActiveX, wasn't that something that Microsoft came out with because they didn't want to use JavaScript?
They didn't want to use
not JavaScript, Java. Yeah.
Java. They said, we're not going to use that. We're going to make our own. And
yeah,
they made their own, and now it's kind of like, oh, man,
and
now we got to keep this going.
Well,
and they disabled some of the functionality of Java. When they enabled Java, they decreased it so it was less
right.
powerful.
It wasn't just about Java, though. It was also about the threat of web browsers. Web browsers make it so that it doesn't matter if you're on a Windows machine or a Mac or a right. Unix machine or something like that. And so they needed some technology that was compelling. It is compelling because
it
runs as fast as any program that's on your system.
So, for example, with an ActiveX component that someone wrote, you could have an amazing image viewing tool right in your browser, right? Faster and better than most websites. There's a lot of things
or,
you can do.
Or something that's... no different than the best, most ornate game that
right.
you could buy. You
well,
could have that
example,
running off of...
For example, there is an ActiveX component to run Word or Acrobat inside your browser. So you open
right.
a web browser and you're actually running Word inside your browser. That's actually very compelling.
Right, but the real push behind ActiveX originally was to make sure that you are running code that is written for Windows.
Right.
So that even though you're using a web browser, that you are not...
Right.
That you have an investment to not migrate over to
right.
an alternative
so,
like
so you're a small
Macintosh.
Shop that's doing a really cool thing with an application. You have a Windows application. The web comes along. You still use your Windows application in an ActiveX wrapper. Very clever.
Right. That was the idea. Unfortunately, it had the unintended consequences of opening up a huge door for viruses and worms.
Right. So Mark from Salinas called in an off-air comment that the best book that Kindle or Amazon could have erased on the Kindle would have been Fahrenheit 451. That would have been like...
That's true.
Getting rid of books. All right. We are taking calls with questions and comments about technology. You can ask us anything you'd like. Who knows if we'll be right, but you can ask.
So that was a comment. He called in with a comment.
I thought it was more like a question.
No, he said, the Fahrenheit.
The Fahrenheit one.
He called in and said, yeah. You know what? They should mention this. And he called in and gave us a comment.
It's awesome.
So that would be a comment as opposed to
I don't know, because Ray Bradbury, while Fahrenheit 451 is a great book, and he did talk about social commentary, I think George Orwell was one that did talk about the oppressive government. And the loss of individual rights far more often. So I still submit that George Orwell is a better case study for that.
Okay.
All right. Whose turn is it for news stories? Al, I think we just did you with the typewriter, right? So, Miles, you're up. 3D?
Yes, there's a...
you choose. You've been doing this for years. You know how to do this show. Go.
Sure. I was going to talk about a 3D webcam. Makes it look like you need the red-blue glasses to use.
Okay. Go on.
So that's the end of that.
I can't do 3D anyway. I don't care.
The one I want to do was the fact that Apple has released an update to iTunes, and it has caused the Palm Pre to fail to sync. You used to be able to use your Palm Pre to sync with iTunes, and iTunes did an update, 8.2.1, that makes it so that it's making sure that it's an Apple product in order to sync the music. And as much as I like Apple, I do, and I have iTunes, and I have an iPhone, and they work wonderfully, I have real issues with this.
Okay, what you're saying is the Palm Pre made an ability to sync to iTunes?
The Palm Pre is a cell phone that is a competitor to the iPhone.
Palm. Made by Palm.
Made by the company Palm.
The hardware side of Palm. Mm-hmm. And they made this great, it's a really good phone, and you can sync it. They made something that allows it to look like an iPod. Is that how it works? Or they just used a protocol that was kind of open to sync to iTunes?
I don't have a Palm Pre. I don't know if one of our listeners has more details on that.
Yeah, okay.
You were able to...
And iTunes is now stopping that, making the sync not happen.
The reason I have a problem with that is the fact that iTunes is a piece of software, and iTunes Music Store is a separate piece where people are putting in their credit cards to purchase songs. And then the iPod or the iPhone or whatever other music player you have is a separate hardware device, separate transaction from all those other ones.
Out of curiosity, is it the syncing of the music or the syncing of the information that is problematic? First off, iPhones don't actually sync, I would say, music. They copy the music from the iTunes onto the and I guess there's a little bit
of syncing. With my iPhone, it's definitely a sync process.
Well, you don't add songs to the phone.
Oh, you most certainly do. You can purchase them on the phone and then sync them back. Sync.
So the information side is what's interesting because, of course, sure, the MP3 is kind of a problem, but if you're downloading the copyrighted songs from the iTunes store or just in general burning your CDs to MP3 or something, you could copy them manually through the Pre software.
The Pre is still a USB storage device, which means that you can copy the MP3s manually.
Well, let me ask you this. If the Pre has some sort of software that manages MP3s, can the iPhone sync to the Pre's software that manages can you take the software that the Zune uses to manage its MP3s? Can you sync that? Can the iPhone sync to that? I mean, did they allow the iPhone to sync to all these other things?
That's an important point.
Have to be? They're the biggest and best and all that, but why do they have to make themselves so? You know, well, you have to make it easy for your competitors.
That's the thing, though. It already worked. They went through extra effort to make
working. iTunes 8.2, it started working, and then it stopped.
So that's one where I have an issue, where they're saying, oh, well, we have a competitor it's a largely different space. You can use iTunes without an iPod on your computer. So that's where I get a little nervous about it. And you're saying when you brought up the Zune, when you brought up Palm Pre, yes, that is an issue of if we have interoperability with other devices. But at the same time, even if that were the case that you couldn't, I do believe that the dominant player has a responsibility in much the same way that Microsoft was a dominant operating system and they had OEM agreements with manufacturers. The fact that they had that dominating force and then were saying, we're going to make sure that you can't put, for example, BOS on the system.
And just to be clear, I mean,
it's an issue. It's a separate issue. It's an antitrust issue.
I agree. It's completely an antitrust issue. The interesting thing is the Palm Pre is relatively new, and when the Palm Pre came out, that's when the announcement happened that, hey, by the way, we'll be able to sync with iTunes. So whether they were doing that with permission or with contracts or whatever is kind of an interesting thing, because if iTunes doesn't have any kind of protocol to do the syncing and you try to figure that out, you're breaking Millennium Copyright Act,
So once again, the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, which
it's really safeguard for large corporations. It's a horrible situation. Just in general, what the Millennium Copyright Act says is if you try to disable any kind of lock or encryption or safety protocols on software or on copyrighted material, then you're breaking the Millennium Copyright Act, which means that if I wrote an email and took the first, did Pig Latin instead of normal English, and you broke that, and it was code in it, theoretically you'd be breaking the Dilithium Copyright Act. It's really kind of insane.
This really does feel to me like back in the day with Ma Bell, AT&T, before it got broken up, the idea of you are not allowed to use, yes, you're paying AT&T for the service and you get the dial tone, and like, but you're not allowed to purchase your own phone that may have better features than the one that is shipped by AT&T.
Right.
That's where I see this as the argument, as saying, wait a second, I have this piece that I paid for, I have this piece that I paid for, and this other third piece has nothing to do with the others except interoperability.
You know, it's a public utility, too. I mean, communication is, you know. I mean, the telephone is different than an entertainment device, you know.
It's true.
But I can see that analogy working.
All right, well, I can see why Apple would want to protect it. I see that, you know, if you have your music,
and
you
want to
sync it.
And I saw why AT&T would want to protect it.
Sure,
but it's
not the right way to... And I appreciate the way you started that article. You know, I use Apple a lot. I have an iPhone. I use the syncing. I like it, and this is not right. Good point. Thank you, Miles. From Aptos, Terry, welcome to GeekSpeak.
Thank you.
What's your question today, Terry?
I went on vacation, and when I returned, my computer wouldn't boot. It would come up with that first screen, and then I would start pressing all the F buttons, trying to get something to happen, and it would take about 15 minutes before I finally got something to happen. Now that I've been back for a week, it's booting fine, but I want to know, is my hard drive going out? Do I need to be prepared for that?
First of all, what's that first screen you're referring to?
I have an E-Tower, so that big E comes up with
So the BIOS screen. Okay.
Yeah.
So first off, you should always be prepared for your hard drive crashing. Your hard drive will break. It will stop working, and you won't be able to get your data off without spending thousands and thousands of dollars. And then sometimes, not even then. And you're out the thousands of dollars, too. So if you have stuff on your computer that you want to have, like right now, if I took your computer away from you, if you would be sad, you need to have a backup solution. And that's for everybody.
I do.
Okay, good.
So
awesome.
I backed everything up.
Thank you. Wonderful. All right, you're fine then. Keep going. Because it'll fail or it won't fail. Is the machine operating slow?
It has been slowing down, and I keep getting this window that says that the memory is low and it has to do something in order to get more memory available.
My first thought on this was that it was possible that your BIOS battery was actually dead. Did you unplug your computer the entire time you were gone?
I think I did.
Okay. So what happens very commonly with an older computer, there's a little battery on the computer that actually... keep some settings fresh, if you will, and that can drain out. The thing is, if that happened, you would assume that it wouldn't boot again because you would have lost all that data. So it was just a thought I had. But the E-machines have this very strange thing where they pop up that image really quick. The BIOS is a little different on the E-machine. They don't want you messing with it. What do you think, Miles? Do you think it could have been a battery problem?
The fact that it's intermittent has...
Now it's fine.
Right, now it's fine.
While,
so.
It's okay.
The thing is, especially as the computer gets older, that battery is not going to hold the charge as well as it first began. So
right.
That seems like a very plausible
And if she unplugged it drains for a period of time. Now she's plugged it in, it's powered up, it's okay.
So I did wrong by unplugging it.
No, you didn't. Please do unplug it.
It's just that as a computer gets older, the battery is going to wear out just in any device. It's kind of like you have the little nightstand clock next to your bed.
Uh-huh.
Sooner or later, if it's not a plug-in model, if it's a battery operated, it's going to run out of battery power.
And you won't know until you have a power outage and it doesn't keep the time.
Right.
You know, just the way it is.
And is that something that can be replaced?
Yeah, it's very simple to replace, actually.
Oh.
It's a little pop-out thing you want to do. The one trick about it is that sometimes the plastic covers, if you do it wrong, you can break them, and then you really got a problem. You got to, like,
yeah.
The
labor to replacing it is more expensive than the battery itself, but it's all still relatively cheap.
If you got a geek in your life that can come by and you give them food or something, they will probably do it, you know, pop up your case, take a look, and then suggest what to buy, and then next time they come over, they'll pop it back.
Usually
in.
They just look like a battery, like a regular battery. I mean, on the Mac
battery, yeah.
Had one, older Macs. These just a little, it looked like a little mini battery, like
yeah,
a little Duracell battery. You just plug it in.
The new ones are normally on a PC, are normally flat.
The flat watch batteries.
The Necco wafer ones.
Yeah.
Right.
Okay.
Don't eat them like Necco wafers either, and don't do communion with them because they're metal and they have acid in them.
It would be bad. Yes.
So the other possibility, of course, is yes, that your hard drive is failing. But since it was doing this thing during the boot sequence, it seems like it's more of a hardware thing. And the other thing about the Eve machines is that I would assume that if it lost the settings in the BIOS, you'd actually have a serious problem. It wouldn't boot anymore. But then I'm thinking about the E-machines, and they really want these things durable, and they don't want people to program their own BIOS. So it's possible they have, like, the detection mechanisms to look for the hard drive and stuff takes a long time the first time, and then it actually sets its BIOS to match your hardware. I could see them doing something like that. So in any case, the battery is the best guess for me. But yeah, make sure you got your data backed up. And remember, hard drives are cheap, right? They're really inexpensive. You can get a new one with lots of space. Do take a look at how much space is on your hard drive.
Right, but yeah. This may not be the hard drive, but yeah. That's...
All right. Thank you so much, Terry, for the call.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. All right. We probably don't have any more time for stories, but, of course, we have the crazy USB device of the week, so stay tuned for that. It's going to be crazy. GeekSpeak on KOSP is supported by Santa Cruz Electronics, offering an extensive selection of computer and electronic parts as well as support services. Santa Cruz Electronics is open daily at 2808 SoCal Avenue and online at santacruzelectronics.com. GeekSpeak is a registered service mark of Online Tonight with David Lawrence and is used by permission. My name is Lyle Troxell. You're listening to GeekSpeak. The geeks today, Miles Elam and Al Luckow, answering our phones every week, volunteering silently so that we have a better show, is Rick Philman. And Rick, thank you so much for doing this. Without you, I don't know how we would do the show. So it's really great. And of course, you, the listeners that listen to us, thank you for sticking with us. And for the people that call in, thanks for figuring out that we need help all the time. Al, crazy USB device of the week. What's
all right?
This week?
It's this company. It's in Japan. It's called Solid Alliance, and they make a lot of USB flash drives. They've made one now that is the world's most expensive USB flash drive. It's $10,000. It's called the Minomisign USM Memory.
Does it have gloves that plug into it to warm them up?
You know, it says it's professionally handcrafted from solid aluminum, buffed to a mirror finish. It's an MNEM.
Wait, it's aluminum, not solid gold?
It's aluminum. It's by Milan-based Italian design studio Toshi Sataji Design. It holds 16 gigabytes of data. But you kind of take it apart. It's kind of like a Rubik's Cube, and it's this big, heavy aluminum block thing. And but $10,000. And then right at the middle, once you take all the aluminum block pieces off, like this little puzzle, in the middle, there's another aluminum block that has the USB thing on it, and that's when you plug in your thing.
So it comes with another pretty thing.
It's like a big sculpture block with a USB heart inside. That's 16 gigs, which is a lot for...
Breaking news right now. This story is now false because I will sell my 16 gig USB device for $12,000.
Wow.
Right now. Okay. It has data on it as well, and I've been using it, and it's been warmed and loved by me and gone through the washing machine at least once.
I've got to have it.
So right there. So that's the most expensive USB device.
It's more.
Yeah.
No kidding.
All right. Well, thank you, Al, very much for that.
And if anybody has these, you know, I mean, you run across these things, send them in.
Yeah.
You
know? We're online all
the
time.
We love stuff like this.
We love this. Robots, yeah. Crazy USB device. Mm-hmm. Tell Miles about political stuff.
Yep.
Tell Ben about new cameras. You can contact us and help us do the show all the time. Of course, on the forums, you can help too. You can help other people. If you have some knowledge about geekery, please join us on the forums at geekspeak.org. This is Central Coast Public Radio, KOSP Santa Cruz, and KBDH San Ardo, streaming live and podcasting at kosp.org.